Well, Lorna Bird, who's the outgoing president of the Western Aboriginal Harm Reduction Society, said straight up at that rally, this is just another residential school system. So there's really a sense of these prisons as being, I call it a successor system to the residential school system. So the people, the Native folks in prison are either residential school survivors or they're the sons or grandchildren of residential school survivors. There's kind of a seamless, if you look at the process of foster care, which was the replacement for residential schools as they were phased out, you see this massive ramping up of foster care. You know, kids, Native kids go into foster care, they go into group homes, and then they go into prison. And something like 45% of Native folks in Canadian prisons are under the age of 25. So it's a very young population. And it's, you know, there's no longer the kind of direct colonial strategy of assimilation that we saw in residential schools, but colonialism hasn't ended. It's just about locking people up now when they become socially problematic, right?
And now it's expanding.
Yeah, it's expanding, and there's reason to think that not only will the disproportionate incarceration of Native folks go down, but it will actually go up, because under the this federal omnibus crime bill legislation, they're actually placing severe limits on some of the strategies that were supposed to be used to de-incarcerate Native folks. So conditional sentences and kind of alternative practices in the community that were starting to be used as an alternative to incarceration for Native folks will no longer be an option for judges under some of these charges where there's mandatory minimums and restrictions on conditional sentencing.
Now, there's the omnibus crime bill of the Conservative federal government, but, you know, the BC government is involved with these prison expansions here. How is this mass incarceration agenda taking place across the country, across jurisdictions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're really looking at it as not just because sometimes it gets played as kind of the Harper agenda, but there's actually this process of criminalization and creating more of a penal police state is taking place across jurisdictions. So there's prison building in every province and territory of the country right now. They're being built right across the country. At the federal level, I think the best way to look at it is in terms of budget. So at the federal level, you can see this multi-billion dollar investment in prisons at the same time as we're coming up on what looks like it's going to be an austerity budget. They're talking about cutting pensions. One of our chants at the action was pensions, not prisons. At the provincial level, we just had a budget from the BC Liberals that is has de facto cuts to health and education. They're investing $336 million building these big prisons. And then at the municipal level, it's the police, and their budgets are untouchable. So in Toronto, the Rob Ford government made cuts to pretty much every city service that you can imagine, except the police, untouchable. In Vancouver, we see steadily escalating police budgets, and again, we're going to see a city budget shortly, which likely will have substantial cuts. But it's highly unlikely that we'll see any cuts to police, because what they do is they just hand down their budget. And you know, in terms of who the police are targeting and filling these prisons with, it's people coming out of poor communities. So there's really this kind of mining enterprise that happens in places like the downtown east side, where the beat cops are walking up and down the street looking for people that they can arrest with not too much work. And that's who's filling these prisons. We know it's not about escalating crime rates. It's not about protecting people. Certainly, to some degree, it's about protecting profit, but to a large degree, it's about protecting police budgets, which means justifying your budgets with these high rates of arrest and incarceration.
I really like your term there, mining enterprises.
Yeah. And I think the other kind of scary thing about this is there is a National Post article that the headline was the largest prison construction boom since the 1930s. And I really think this is also connected to economic crisis and what the response to the economic crisis is going to be. And we know it's not going to be expansion of the welfare state. I mean, that's pretty evident right now. Nobody's talking about increasing welfare rates or expanding EI or, you know, substantial job creation programs. So what we're having instead is expansion of the penal state, more police, more prisons, more spending on military. So I think we have to look at the big picture too, which is that the plan in the economic crisis is not to deal with poverty and unemployment through any kind of progressive Keynesian spending. It's going to be through locking people up and intimidating people.
So how would you suggest people support this fight back?
Well, I think, first of all, people just need to know that it's happening. Like, particularly with the prison building, it's shocking. And if people, if you Google that, a National Post article, you can read about this massive prison expansion across the country. It's really important. And just getting involved in raising awareness about it, I think, is the first step. And having the discussion about rates of incarceration really be on the agenda and up for discussion in our communities. Because right now, I think it's fairly hidden, and the people who are targeted are really marginalized. So they don't have a lot of capacity to illuminate what's going on in a lot of ways.
Well, thank you so much, Ines, for joining us in the studio and illuminating this complex, dynamic topic.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Ines Ormond. Ines is an organizer with VANDU, the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users.
Now, I hope that served to underline the ongoing nature of the enclosure process. We're now going to zap backwards in time to the Middle Ages, where we'll be picking up from Chapter 9 of Debt, the first 5,000 years. We're now going to be looking at perhaps that most enclosed of all public spaces, the realm of money. Now, I think this is a very important piece of history because the flexible nature of money, in particular the frequent debt amnesties, is a story which is never told on the commercially controlled media. This is something the rich don't want people to be reminded of, as of course is their obvious and historically proven power to trump so-called law and order if they can act in a coherent fashion. Now, have people really become so stultified, and has the power of those who would govern us become so enhanced by modern technologies our resistance is really futile? Let's just refresh ourselves about what was possible in the past by hearing from anthropologist David Graeber.
Chapter 10, The Middle Ages, 600 to 1450 AD. It begins with a quote from St. Thomas Aquinas, quote, "Artificial wealth comprises things which of themselves satisfy no natural need, for example, money, which is a human contrivance," unquote. If the Axial Age saw the emergence of complementary ideals of commodity markets and universal world religions, the Middle Ages were the period in which these two institutions began to merge. Everywhere, the age began with the collapse of empires. Eventually, new states formed. But in these new states, the nexus between war, bullion, and slavery was broken. Conquest and acquisition for their own sake were no longer celebrated as the end of all political life. At the same time, economic life, from the conduct of international trade to the organization of local markets, came to fall increasingly under the regulation of religious authorities. One result was a widespread movement to control, or even forbid, predatory lending.
Another was a return across Eurasia to various forms of virtual credit money.
Granted, this is not the way we're used to thinking of the Middle Ages. For most of us, medieval remains a synonym for superstition, intolerance, and oppression. Yet, for most of the Earth's inhabitants, it could only be seen as an extraordinary improvement over the terrors of the Axial Age. One reason for our skewed perception is that we're used to thinking of the Middle Ages as something that happened primarily in Western Europe, in territories that had been little more than border outposts of the Roman Empire to begin with. According to the conventional wisdom, with the collapse of the empire, the cities were largely abandoned and the economy, quote, reverted to barter, taking at least 5 centuries to recover. Even for Europe, though, this is based on a series of unquestioned assumptions that, as I've said, crumble the moment one starts seriously poking at them. Chief among them is the idea that the absence of coins means the absence of money, True, the destruction of the Roman war machine also meant that Roman coins went out of circulation, and the few coins produced within the Gothic or Frankish kingdoms that established themselves over the ruins of the old empire were largely fiduciary in nature. Still, a glance at the barbarian law codes reveals that even at the height of the Dark Ages, people were still carefully keeping accounts in Roman money as they calculated interest rates, contracts, and mortgages. Again, cities shriveled, and many were abandoned, but even this was something of a mixed blessing. Certainly, it had a terrible effect on literacy. But one must also bear in mind that ancient cities could only be maintained by extracting resources from the countryside. Roman Gaul, for instance, had been a network of cities, connected by the famous Roman roads, to an endless succession of slave plantations which were owned by the urban grandees. After around 400 AD, the population of the towns declined radically, but the plantations also disappeared. In the following centuries, many came to be replaced by manors, churches, and even later, castles, where the new local lords extracted their own dues from the surrounding farmers. But one need only do the math. Since medieval agriculture was no less efficient than ancient agriculture, in fact, it rapidly became a great deal more so, the amount of work required to feed a handful of mounted warriors and clergymen couldn't possibly have been anything like that required to feed entire cities. However oppressed medieval serfs might have been, their plight was nothing compared with that of their Axial Age equivalents. Still, the Middle Ages proper are best seen as having begun not in Europe but in India and China, between 400 and 600 AD, and then sweeping across much of the western half of Eurasia with the advent of Islam. They only really reached Europe 400 years later. Let us begin our story, then, in India. Medieval India. Flight into hierarchy. I left off in India with Ashoka's embrace of Buddhism, but I noted that ultimately his project foundered. Neither his empire nor his church was to endure. It took a good deal of time, however, for this failure to occur. The Mauryans represented a high water mark of empire. The next 500 years saw a succession of kingdoms, most of them strongly supportive of Buddhism. Stupas and monasteries sprang up everywhere, but the states that sponsored them grew weaker and weaker. Centralized armies dissolved. Soldiers, like officials, increasingly came to be paid by land grants rather than salaries. As a result, the number of coins in circulation steadily declined. Here, too, the early Middle Ages witnessed a dramatic decline of cities, where the Greek ambassador Megasthenes described Ashoka's capital of Patna as the largest city in the world of his day, medieval Arab and Chinese travellers described India as a land of endless tiny villages. As a result, most historians have come to write, much as they do in Europe, of a collapse of the money economy, of commerce becoming a reversion to barter. Here, too, this appears to be simply untrue. What vanished were the military means to extract resources from the peasants. In fact, Hindu law books written at the time show increasing attention to credit arrangements, with a sophisticated language of sureties, collateral, mortgages, promissory notes, and compound interest. One need only consider how the Buddhist establishments were popping up all over India during these centuries were funded. While the earliest monks were wandering mendicants, owning little more than their begging bowls, early medieval monasteries were often magnificent establishments with vast treasuries. Still, in principle, their operations were financed almost entirely through credit. The key innovation was the creation of what were called the perpetual endowments, or inexhaustible treasuries. Say a lay supporter wished to make a contribution to her local monastery. Rather than offering to provide candles for a specific ritual, or servants to attend the upkeep of the monastic grounds, she would provide a certain sum of money, or something worth a great deal of money, that would then be loaned out in the name of the monastery at the accepted 15% annual rate. The interest on the loan would then be earmarked for that specific purpose. An inscription discovered at the great monastery of Sanchi, sometime around 450 AD, provides a handy illustration. A woman named Harishvamini donates the relatively modest sum of 12 dinars to the noble community of monks. The text carefully inscribes how the income is to be divided up. The interest on 5 of the dinars was to provide the daily meals for 5 different monks. The interest from another 3 would pay to light 3 lamps for the Buddha, in memory of her parents, and so forth. The inscription ends by saying that this was a permanent endowment, created with a document in stone to last as long as the moon and the sun. Since the principal would never be touched, the contribution would last forever. Some of these loans presumably went to individuals. Others were commercial loans to guilds of bamboo workers, braziers and potters, or to village assemblies. We have to assume that in most cases the money is an accounting unit. What were really being transacted were animals, wheat, silk, butter, fruit, and all the other goods whose appropriate rates of interest were so carefully stipulated in the law codes of the time. Still, large amounts of gold did end up flowing into monastic coffers. When coins go out of circulation, after all, the metal doesn't simply disappear. In the Middle Ages, and this seems to have been true across Eurasia, the vast majority of it ended up in religious establishments. Churches, monasteries, and temples either stockpiled in hoards and treasuries, or gilded onto or cast into altars, sanctums, and sacred instruments. Above all, it was shaped into images of gods. As a result, those rulers who did try to put an Axial Age-style coinage system back into circulation, invariably to fund some project of military expansion, often had to pursue self-consciously anti-religious policies in order to do so. Probably the most notorious was one Harsa, who ruled Kashmir from 1089 to 1101 AD, who is said to have appointed an officer called the Superintendent for the Destruction of the Gods. According to later histories, Harsha employed leprous monks to systematically desecrate divine images with urine and excrement, thus neutralizing their power, before dragging them off to be melted down. He is said to have destroyed more than 4,000 Buddhist establishments
before being betrayed and killed, the last of his dynasty.
And his miserable fate was long held out as an example of where the revival of the old ways was likely to lead one in the end. For the most part, then, the gold remained sacrosanct, laid up in the sacred places, though in India, over time, these were increasingly Hindu ones, not Buddhist. What we now see as a traditional Hindu village India appears to have been largely a creation of the early Middle Ages. We do not precisely know how it happened. As kingdoms continued to rise and fall, the world inhabited by kings and princes became increasingly distant from that of most people's everyday affairs. During much of the period immediately following the collapse of the Mauryan Empire, for instance, much of India was governed by foreigners. Apparently, this increasing distance allowed local Brahmins to begin reshaping the new, increasingly rural, society along strictly hierarchical principles. They did it, above all, by seizing control of the administration of the law. The Dharma Shastra, law codes produced by Brahmin scholars between roughly 200 BC and 400 AD, give us a good idea of the new vision of society. In it, old ideas like the Vedic conception of a debt to gods, sages, and ancestors were resuscitated, but now they applied only and specifically to Brahmins, whose duty and privilege it was to stand in for all humanity before the forces that controlled the universe. Far from being required to attain learning, members of the inferior classes were forbidden to do so. The laws of Manu, for instance, set down that any Sudra, the lowest caste, assigned to farming and material production, who so much as listened in on the teaching of the law or sacred texts, should have molten lead poured into their ears, on the occasion of a repeat offence, have their tongues cut out. At the same time, Brahmins, however ferociously they guarded their privileges, also adopted aspects of once radical Buddhist and Jain ideas, like karma, reincarnation, and ahimsa. Brahmins were expected to refrain from any sort of physical violence and even to become vegetarians. In alliance with representatives of the old warrior caste, they also managed to win control of most of the land in the ancient villages. artisans and craftsmen, fleeing the decline or destruction of cities, often ended up as suppliant refugees, and gradually low-caste clients. The result were increasingly complex local patronage systems in the countryside, Jajmani systems, as they came to be known, where the refugees provided services for the landowning castes, who took on many of the roles once held by the state, providing protection and justice, extracting labour dues, and so on, but also protected local communities from actual royal representatives. This latter function is crucial. Foreign visitors were later to be awed by the self-sufficiency of the traditional Indian village, with its elaborate system of landowning castes, farmers, and such service castes as barbers, smiths, tanners, drummers, washermen, all arranged in hierarchical order, each seen as making its own unique and necessary contribution to their little society, all of it typically operating entirely without the use of metal currency. It was only possible for those reduced to the status of sudras and untouchables to have a chance of accepting their lowly position, because the exaction of local landlords was again on nothing like the same scale as that under earlier governments, under which villages had to support cities of upwards of 1 million people, and because the village community became an effective means of holding the state and its representatives, at least partially, at bay. We don't know the mechanisms that brought this world about, but the role of debt was surely significant. The creation of thousands of Hindu temples alone must have involved hundreds of thousands, even millions of interest-bearing loans. Since, while Brahmins were themselves forbidden to lend money at interest, temples were not. We can already see, in the earliest of the new law codes, the laws of Manu, the way that local authorities were struggling to reconcile old customs like debt peonage and chattel slavery with the desire to establish an overarching hierarchical system in which everyone knew their place. The laws of Manu carefully classify slaves into 7 types, depending on how they were reduced to slavery, war, debt, self-sale, and so on, and explain the conditions under which each might be emancipated, but then go on to say that sudras can never really be emancipated, since, after all, they were created to serve the other castes. Similarly, where earlier codes had established a 15% annual rate of interest, with exceptions for commercial loans, the new codes organized interest by caste, stating that one could charge a maximum of 2% a month for a Brahmin, 3% for a Kshatriya, a warrior, 4% for a Vaishya, a merchant, and 5% for a Sudra, which is the difference between 24% annually on the one extreme and a hefty 60% on the other. The laws also identify 5 different ways interest can be paid, of which the most significant for our concerns is bodily interest. Physical labour in the creditor's house or fields to be rendered until such time as the principal is cleared. Even here, though, caste considerations were paramount. No one could be forced into the service of anyone of a lower caste. Moreover, since debts were enforceable on a debtor's children and even grandchildren, until the principal is cleared, could mean quite some time, as Indian historian R.S. Sharma notes, such stipulations, quote, remind us of the present practice according to which several generations of the same family have been reduced to the position of hereditary ploughmen in consideration of some paltry sum advanced to them, unquote. Indeed, India has become notorious as a country in which a very large part of the working population is labouring in effective debt peonage to a landlord or some other creditor. Such arrangements became even easier over time. By about 1000 AD, restrictions on usury by members of the upper castes in Hindu law codes largely disappeared. On the other hand, 1000 AD was about the same time that Islam appeared in India, a religion dedicated to eradicating usury altogether. So, at the very least, we can say that these things never stopped being contested, and even Hindu law of that time was far more humane than almost anything found in the ancient world. Debtors were not, generally speaking, reduced to slavery, and there is no widespread evidence of the selling of women or children. In fact, overt slavery had largely vanished from the countryside by this time, and debt peons were not even pawns, exactly. By law, they were simply paying interest on a freely contracted agreement. Even when that took generations, the law stipulated that even if the principal was never paid, In the third generation, they would be freed. There is a peculiar tension here, a kind of paradox. Debt and credit arrangements may well have played a crucial role in creating the Indian village system, but they could never really become their basis. It might have made a certain sense to declare that just as Brahmins had to dispatch their debts to the gods, everyone should be, in a certain sense, in debt to those above them, but in another sense, that would have completely subverted the very idea of caste, which was that the universe was a vast hierarchy in which different sorts of people were assumed to be of fundamentally different natures, that these ranks and grades were fixed forever, and that when goods and services moved up and down the hierarchy, they followed not principles of exchange at all, but, as in all hierarchical systems, custom and precedent. The French anthropologist Louis Dumont made the famous argument that one cannot even really talk about inequality here, because to use that phrase implies that one believes people should or could be equal, and that this idea was completely alien to Hindu conceptions. For them, to have imagined their responsibilities as debts would have been profoundly subversive, since debts are by definition arrangements between equals, at least in the sense that they're equal parties to a contract that could and should be repaid. Politically, it's never a particularly good idea to first tell people that you're all equals, and then humiliate and degrade them. This is presumably why peasant interactions from Chiapas to Japan have so regularly aimed to wipe out debts, rather than focus on more structural issues like caste systems or even slavery. The British Raj discovered this, to their occasional chagrin, when they used debt peonage, superimposed on the caste system, as the basis of their labour system in colonial India. Perhaps the paradigmatic popular insurrection was the Deccan riots of 1875, when indebted farmers rose up to seize and systematically destroy the account books of local moneylenders. Debt peonage, it would appear, is far more likely to inspire outrage and collective action than is a system premised on pure inequality. China, Buddhism and the economy of infinite debt. By medieval standards, India was unusual for resisting the appeal of the great Axial Age religions. But we observe the basic pattern. The decline of empire, armies and the cash economy, the rise of religious authorities, independent of the state, who win much of their popular legitimacy through their ability to regulate emerging credit systems. China might be said to represent the opposite extreme. This was the one place where a late Axial Age attempt to yoke empire and religion together was a complete success. True, here as elsewhere, there was an initial period of breakdown after the collapse of the Han Dynasty around 220 AD. The central state broke apart, cities shrank, coins disappeared, and so on. But in China this was only temporary. As Max Weber long ago pointed out, once one sets up a genuinely effective bureaucracy, it's almost impossible to get rid of it. And the Chinese bureaucracy was uniquely effective. Before long, the old Han system re-emerged. A centralized state, run by Confucian scholar gentry, trained in the literary classics, selected through a national exam system, working in meticulously organized national and regional bureaus, where the money supply, like other economic matters, was continually monitored and regulated. Chinese monetary theory was always charterless. This was partly just an effect of size. The empire and its internal market were so huge that foreign trade was never especially important. Therefore, those running the government were well aware that they could turn pretty much anything into money, simply by insisting that taxes be paid in that form. The two great threats to the authorities were always the same. The nomadic peoples to the north, whom they systematically bribed, but who nonetheless periodically swept over and conquered sections of China, and popular unrest and rebellion. The latter was almost constant, and on a scale unknown anywhere else in human history. There were decades in Chinese history when the rate of recorded peasant uprisings was roughly 1.8 per hour. What's more, such uprisings were frequently successful. Most of the most famous Chinese dynasties that were not the product of barbarian invasion, the Yuan or Qing, were originally peasant insurrections, the Han, Tang, Sung, and Ming. In no other part of the world do we see anything like this. As a result, Chinese statecraft ultimately came down to funneling enough resources to the cities to feed the urban population and keep the nomads at bay, without causing a notoriously contumacious rural population to rise up in arms. The official Confucian ideology of patriarchal authority, equal opportunity, promotion of agriculture, light taxes, and careful government control of merchants seemed expressly designed to appeal to the interests and sensibilities of potentially rebellious rural patriarch. One need hardly add that in these circumstances, limiting the depredations of the local village loan shark, the traditional bane of rural families, was a constant government concern. Over and over, we hear the same familiar story. Peasants down on their luck, whether due to natural disaster or the need to pay for a parent's funeral, would fall into the hands of predatory lenders who would seize their fields and houses, forcing them to work or pay rent in what had once been their own lands. The threat of rebellion would then drive the government to institute a dramatic program of reforms. One of the first we know about came in the form of a coup d'etat in 9 AD, when a Confucian official named Wang Meng seized the throne to deal, so he claimed, with a nationwide debt crisis. According to proclamations made at the time, the practice of usury had caused the effective tax rate, that is, the amount of the average peasant's harvest that ended up being carried off by someone else, to rise from just over 3% to 50%. In reaction, Wang Ming instituted a program reforming the currency, nationalizing large estates, promoting state-run industries, including public granaries, and banning private holding of slaves. Wang Ming also established a state loan agency that would offer interest-free funeral loans for up to 90 days for those caught unprepared by the death of relatives, as well as long-term loans of 3% monthly or 10% annual income rates for commercial or agricultural investments. With this scheme, one historian remarks, quote, Wang was confident that all business transactions would be under his scrutiny and the absence of usury would be forever eradicated, unquote. Needless to say, it wasn't, and later Chinese history is full of similar stories, widespread inequality and unrest, followed by the appointment of official commissions of inquiry, regional debt relief, either blanket amnesties or annulments of all loans in which interest had exceeded the principal. Cheap grain loans, famine relief, laws against the selling of children. All this became the standard fare of government policy. It was very unevenly successful. It certainly didn't create an egalitarian peasant utopia, but it prevented any widespread return to axial age conditions. We're used to thinking of such bureaucratic interventions, particularly the monopolies and regulations, as state restriction on the market, owing to the prevailing prejudice that sees markets as quasi-natural phenomena that emerge by themselves, and governments as having no role other than to squelch or siphon from them. I've repeatedly pointed out how mistaken this is, but China provides a particularly striking example. The Confucian state may have been the world's greatest and most enduring bureaucracy, but it actively promoted markets, and as a result, commercial life in China soon became far more sophisticated, and markets more developed than anywhere else in the world. And this despite the fact that Confucian orthodoxy was overtly hostile to merchants, and even the profit motive itself. Commercial profit was seen as legitimate only as compensation for the labour that merchants expended in transporting goods from one place to another, but never as fruits of speculation. What this meant in practice was that they were pro-market but anti-capitalist. Again, this seems bizarre, since we're used to assuming that capitalism and markets are the same thing. But, as the great French historian Fernand Braudel pointed out, in many ways they could equally well be conceived as opposites. While markets are ways of exchanging goods through the medium of money, historically ways for those with a surplus of grain to acquire candles and vice versa, in economic shorthand, C to M to C dashed, a commodity to money to other commodity, capitalism is first and foremost the art of using money to get more money. M to C to M dash. Normally, the easiest way to do this is by establishing some kind of formal or de facto monopoly. For this reason, capitalists, whether merchant princes, financiers, or industrialists, invariably try to ally themselves with political authorities to limit the freedom of the market, so as to make it easier for them to do so. From this perspective, China was, for most of its history, the ultimate anti-capitalist market state. Unlike later European princes, Chinese rulers systematically refused to team up with would-be Chinese capitalists, who always existed. Instead, like their officials, they saw them as destructive parasites, though, unlike the usurers, ones whose fundamentally selfish and antisocial motivations could still be put to use in certain ways. In Confucian terms, merchants were like soldiers. Those drawn to a career in the military were assumed to be driven largely by a love of violence. As individuals, they were not good people, but they were also necessary to defend the frontiers. Similarly, merchants were driven by greed and basically immoral. Yet, if kept under careful administrative supervision, they could be made to serve the public good. Whatever one might think of the principles, the results are hard to deny. For most of its history, China maintained the highest standard of living in the world. Even England only really overtook it in perhaps the 1820s, well past the time of the Industrial Revolution. Confucianism is not precisely a religion, perhaps. It's usually considered more of an ethical and philosophical system. So China, too, could be considered something of a departure from the common medieval pattern, whereby commerce was, almost everywhere, brought under the control of religion. But it wasn't a complete departure. One need only consider the remarkable economic role of Buddhism in the same period. Buddhism had arrived in China through the Central Asia caravan routes and, in its early days, was largely a religion promoted by merchants. But, in the chaos following the collapse of the Han dynasty in 220 AD, it began to take popular roots. The Liang, 502-557, and Tang, 618-907, dynasties saw outbreaks of passionate religious fervour, in which thousands of young rural people across China would renounce their farms, shops, and families, seek ordination as Buddhist monks and nuns. Where merchants or landed magnates pledged their entire fortunes for the propagation of the Dharma. Building projects hollowed out whole mountains to create bodhisattvas and giant statues of the Buddha. And pageants where monks and devotees ritually burned their heads and hands, or in some instances, set themselves on fire. By the mid-5th century, there were dozens of such spectacular suicides. They became, as one historian put it, a macabre kind of fashion. Historians differ over their meaning. Certainly the passions unleashed provided a dramatic alternative to the staid orthodoxy of the Confucian literati. But it's also surprising, to say the least, to see this in a religion promoted above all by the commercial classes. The French sinologist Jacques Guénée observes, quote, "It is clear that these suicides, so contrary to traditional morality, aim to redeem the sins of all beings, to compel the gods and men at one and the same time. And they were staged. Usually, in the 5th century, a pyre was erected on a mountain. The suicide took place in the presence of a large crowd, uttering lamentations and bringing forward rich offerings. People of all social ranks attended the spectacle together. After the fire had burned out, the ashes of the monk were collected, and the stupa, a new place of worship, was created to house them."
Guénée's picture of dozens of Christ-like redeemers seems overstated, but the precise meaning of these suicides was unclear and widely debated, even in the Middle Ages. Some contemporaries saw them as the ultimate expression of contempt for the body, others as recognition of the illusory nature of the self and all material attachments, yet others as the ultimate form of charity, the giving of that which can only be most precious, one's very physical existence, as a sacrifice to the benefit of all living things. a sentiment that one 10th-century biographer expressed in the following verses. To give away the thing that is difficult to part with is the best offering among the alms. Let the impure and sinful body turn into something like a diamond, that is, an object of eternal value, an investment that can bear fruit for all eternity. I draw attention to this, because this sentiment provides an elegant illustration of a problem that seems to have first appeared in the world with notions of pure charity that always seemed to accompany Axial Age religions, and which provided endless philosophical conundrums. In human economies, it doesn't appear to have occurred to anyone that any act could be either purely selfish or purely altruistic. As I noted in Chapter 5, an act of absolute selfless giving can only be absolutely anti-social, hence, in a way, inhuman. It's merely the mirror image of an act of theft or even murder. Hence, it makes a certain sort of sense that suicide be conceived as the ultimate selfless gift. Yet, this is the door that necessarily opens as soon as one develops a notion of profit and then tries to conceive its opposite. This tension seems to hang over the life of medieval Chinese Buddhism, which, true to its commercial origins, retained a striking tendency to employ the language of the marketplace. One purchases felicity and sells one's sins, wrote one monk, just as in commercial operations. Nowhere was this so true as in those schools, such as the School of the Three Stages, that adopted the notion of karmic debt, that each of the sins of one's accumulated past lives continues as a debt needing to be discharged. An obscure and unusual view in classical Indian Buddhism, the notion of karmic debt took on a powerful new life in China. As one three-stage text puts it, we all know that insolvent debtors will be reborn as animals or slaves, but in reality, we're all insolvent debtors, because acquiring the new money to repay our temporal debts necessarily means acquiring new spiritual ones, since every means of acquiring wealth will necessarily involve exploiting, damaging, and causing suffering to other living beings. Quote, some use their power and authority as officials in order to bend the law and seize wealth. Some prosper in the marketplace. They engage in an excess of lies and cheat and extort profits from others. Still others, farmers, burn the mountains and marshes, flood the fields, plough and mill, destroying the nests and burrows of animals. There is no avoiding the fact of our past debts, and it's difficult to comprehend the number of separate lives it would require if you wanted to pay them one by one. Unquote. As Genet remarks, the idea of life as an endless burden of debt would surely have struck a chord with Chinese villagers, for whom this was all too often literally true. But, as he also points out, like their counterparts in ancient Israel, they were also familiar with that sense of sudden liberation that came with official amnesties. There was a way to achieve that, too. All that was required was to make regular donations to some monastery's inexhaustible treasury. The moment one does so, the debts from every one of one's past lives are instantly blotted out. The author even provides a little parable, not unlike Jesus's parable of the ungrateful servant, but far more optimistic. How, it might be asked, would a poor man's tiny contribution possibly have such cosmic effects? Quote, answer, in a parable, it is like a poor man burdened by a debt of 1,000 strings of coins to another person. He always suffers from his debt, and the poor man is afraid whenever the debt master comes to collect. He visits the rich man's house and confesses he is beyond the time limit and begs forgiveness for his offence. He is poor and without a station in life. He tells him that each day he makes a single coin, he will return it to the rich man. On hearing this, the rich man is very pleased and forgives him for being overdue. Moreover, the poor man is not dragged away to jail. Giving to the inexhaustible storehouse is also like this. Unquote. One might almost call this salvation on the instalment plan, but the implication is that the payments shall be made, like the interest payments on the wealth, when it is subsequently loaned out, for all eternity. Other schools concentrated not on karmic debt, but on one's debt to one's parents. Where Confucius built their system of morality above all on filial piety to fathers, Chinese Buddhists were primarily concerned with mothers, and with the care and suffering required in raising, feeding, and educating children.
The mother's kindness is unlimited, her selflessness absolute. This was seen to be embodied above all in the act of breastfeeding, the fact that mothers transform their very flesh and blood into milk. They feed their children with their own bodies. In doing so, however, they allow unlimited love to be precisely quantified. One author calculated that the average infant absorbs precisely 180 pecks of mother's milk in its first 3 years of life, and this constitutes its debt as an adult. The figure soon became canonical. To repay this milk debt, or indeed one's debt to one's parents more generally, was simply impossible. If you stacked up jewels from the ground up to the 28th heaven, wrote one Buddhist author, it would not compare with the value of your parents' nurturance. Even if you were to cut your own flesh to offer her 3 times a day for 4 billion years, wrote another, it would not pay back even a single day of what your mother did for you. The solution, however, is the same: donating money to the inexhaustible treasuries. The result was an elaborate cycle of debts and forms of redemption. A man begins with an unpayable milk debt. The only thing of comparable value is the Dharma, the Buddhist truth itself. One can thus repay one's parents by bringing them to Buddhism. Indeed, this can be done even after death, when one's mother will otherwise wind up as a hungry ghost in hell. If one makes a donation to the inexhaustible treasuries in her name, sutras will be recited for her, she will be delivered. The money, in the meantime, will be put partly to work as charity, as pure gift, but partly too, as in India, as interest-bearing loans, earmarked for specific purposes for the furtherance of Buddhist education, ritual, or monastic life. The Chinese Buddhist approach to charity was nothing if not multifaceted. Festivals often led to vast outpourings of contributions, with wealthy adherents vying for one another in generosity, often driving their entire fortunes to the monasteries, in the forms of ox carts laden with millions of strings of cash, a kind of economic self-immolation that paralleled the spectacular monastic suicides. Their contributions swelled the inexhaustible treasuries. Some would be given to the needy, particularly in times of hardship. Some would be loaned. One practice that hovered between charity and business was providing peasants with alternatives to the local moneylender. Most monasteries had attendant pawn shops, where the local poor could place some valuable possession, a robe, a couch, a mirror, in hock in exchange for low-interest loans. Finally, there was the business of the monastery itself. That portion of the inexhaustible treasury turned over to the management of lay brothers, and either put out at loan or invested. Since monks were not allowed to eat the products of their own fields, the fruit or grain had to be put on the market, further swelling monastic revenues. Most monasteries came to be surrounded not only by commercial farms, but veritable industrial complexes of oil presses, flour mills, shops, and hostels, often with thousands of bonded workers. At the same time, the treasuries themselves became, as Guinier was perhaps the first to point out, the world's first genuine forms of concentrated finance capital. They were, after all, enormous concentrations of wealth managed by what were in effect monastic corporations, which were constantly seeking new opportunities for profitable investment. They even shared the quintessential capitalist imperative of continual growth. The treasuries had to expand, since, according to the Mahayana doctrine, genuine liberation would not be possible until the whole world embraced the Dharma. This was precisely the situation, huge concentrations of capital interested in nothing more than profit, that Confucian economic policy was supposed to prevent. Still, it took some time for Chinese governments to recognize the threat. Government attitudes veered back and forth. At first, especially in the chaotic years of the early Middle Ages, monks were welcomed, even given generous land grants and provided with convict laborers to reclaim forests and marshes, and tax-exempt status for their business enterprises. A few emperors converted. While most of the bureaucracy kept the monks at arm's length, Buddhism became especially popular with court women, as well as with eunuchs and many scions of wealthy families. As time went on, though, administrators turned from seeing monks as a boon to rural society to its potential ruination. Already by 511 AD, There were decrees condemning monks for diverting grain that was supposed to be used for charitable purposes to high-interest loans, and altering debt contracts. A government commission had to be appointed to review the accounts and nullify any loans in which interest was found to have exceeded principal. In 713 AD, we have another decree, confiscating two inexhaustible treasuries of the Three Stages sect, whose members they accused of fraudulent solicitation. Before long, there were major campaigns of government repression, at first often limited to certain regions, but over time more often empire-wide. During the most severe, carried out in 845 AD, a total of 4,600 monasteries were razed, along with their shops and mills. 260,000 monks and nuns forcibly defrocked and returned to their families, but at the same time, according to government reports, 150,000 temple serfs released from bondage. Whatever the real reasons behind the waves of repression, and these were no doubt many, the official reason was always the same, a need to restore the money supply. The monasteries were becoming so large and so rich, administrators insisted, that China was simply running out of metal. Quote, great repressions of Buddhism under the Chao Emperor Wu between 574 and 577, under Wu Zong in 842 to 845, and finally in 955, presented themselves primarily as measures of economic recovery. Each of them provided an opportunity for the imperial government to procure the necessary copper for the minting of new coins. Unquote. One reason is that monks appear to have been systematically melting down strings of coins, often hundreds of thousands at a time, to build colossal copper or even gilded copper statues of the Buddha, along with other objects such as bells and copper chimes, or even such extravagances as mirrored halls or gilded copper roof tiles. The result, according to official commissions of inquiry, was economically disastrous. The price of metals would soar, coinage disappear, and rural marketplaces cease to function, even as those rural people whose children had not become monks often fell deeper into debt to the monasteries. It perhaps stands to reason that Chinese Buddhism, a religion of merchants that then took popular roots, should have developed in this direction. A genuine theology of debt, even perhaps a practice of absolute self-sacrifice, of abandoning everything, one's fortune or even one's life, that ultimately led to collectively managed finance capital. The reason that the result seems so weird, so full of paradoxes, is that it is again an attempt to apply the logic of exchange to questions of eternity. Recall an idea from earlier in the book. Exchange, unless it's an instantaneous cash transaction, creates debts. Debts linger over time. If you imagine all human relations as exchange, then, insofar as people do have ongoing relations with one another, these relations are laced with debt and sin. The only way out is to annihilate the debt, but then social relations vanish too. This is quite in accord with Buddhism, whose ultimate aim is indeed the attainment of emptiness, absolute liberation, the annihilation of all human and material attachments, since these are ultimately causes of suffering. For Mahayana Buddhists, however, absolute liberation cannot be achieved by any one being independently. The liberation of each depends on all the others. Therefore, until the end of time, such matters are in a certain sense always in suspension. In the meantime, exchange dominates. One purchases facility and sells one's sins, just as in commercial operations. Even acts of charity and self-sacrifice are not purely generous. One is purchasing merit from the bodhisattvas. The notion of infinite debt comes in when this logic slams up against the absolute, or, one might perhaps better say, against something that utterly defies the logic of exchange. Because there are things that do. This would explain, for instance, the odd urge to first quantify the exact amount of milk one has absorbed at one's mother's breast, and then to say that there is no conceivable way to repay it. Exchange implies interaction between equivalent beings. Your mother, on the other hand, is not an equivalent being. She created you out of her own flesh. This is exactly the point that I suggested the Vedic authors were subtly trying to make when they talked about debts to the gods,
Of course, you can't really pay your debt to the universe. That would imply that one, you, and two, everything that exists, including you, are in some sense equivalent entities. This is clearly absurd. The closest you can come to repayment is simply to recognize that fact. Such recognition is the true meaning of sacrifice. Like Hosbabe's original money, a sacrificial offering is not a way to pay a debt, but a way to acknowledge the impossibility of the idea that there could ever be repayment. Quote, "The parallel was not missed in certain mythological traditions. According to one famous Hindu myth, two gods, the brothers Kartikeya and Ganesha, had a quarrel over who should be the first to marry. Their mother, Parvati, suggested a contest. The winner would be the one who could most quickly circle the entire universe. Kartikeya set off on the back of a giant peacock. It took him 3 years to transverse the limits of the cosmos. Ganesha bided his time, then, finally, walked in a circle around his mother, remarking, 'You are the universe to me.'" Unquote. I've also argued that any system of exchange is always necessarily founded on something else, something that, in its social manifestation at least, is ultimately communism. With all those beings that we treat as eternal, that we assume will always be there, our mother's love, true friendship, sociality, humanity, belonging, the existence of the cosmos, no calculation is necessary, or even ultimately possible. Insofar as there is give and take, they follow completely different principles. What, then, happens to such absolute and unlimited phenomena when one tries to imagine the world as a set of transactions, as exchange? Generally, one of two things. We either ignore or deify them. Mothers, and caregiving women in general, are a classic case in point. Or we do both. What we treat as eternal in our actual relations with one another vanishes and reappears as an abstraction, an absolute. In the case of Buddhism, this was framed as the inexhaustible merit of bodhisattvas, who exist, in a certain sense, outside of time. They are at once the model for the inexhaustible treasuries, and also their practical foundation. One can only repay one's endless karmic debt, or one's infinite milk debt, by drawing on this equally infinite pool of redemption, which, in turn, becomes the basis for the actual material funds of the monasteries, which are equally eternal. A pragmatic form of communism, in fact, since they were vast pools of wealth, collectively owned and collectively managed, the centre of vast projects of human cooperation, which were assumed to be similarly eternal. Yet, at the same time, here I think Genet is right, this communism became the basis, in turn, of something very much like capitalism. The reason was, above all, the need for constant expansion. Everything, even charity, was an opportunity to proselytize, and dharma had to grow, ultimately, to encompass everyone and everything, in order to effect the salvation of all living beings.
And that's where we're going to leave David Graeber this week, due to time. An intriguing parallel with the drive for perpetual growth due to the interest on the unpayable debt of the modern money system. If you'd like to hear this show again, or any others, they're available for download from our archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. We have a Twitter feed at twitter.com/unwelcomeguests. This show's music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can.